comes now time to introduce our speaker, and I believe an MC's job is to just tell you the speaker's name and let him talk. But this man just gave me a very unusual introduction to make for him. He says that he's just a plain, down-to-earth, country-type Jesus. And with that, I give you Clancy.
My name is Clancy Imisland, and I'm an alcoholic. We're going to start a new system tonight, friends. In California, whenever a speaker, discussion meeting, if it's 20 speakers, anytime somebody says, "My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic," everybody there says,
"Hi, Joe."
So I'm going to start over again. I'd like to have a little more juice from the house, if you don't mind. My name is Clancy, and I'm an alcoholic. Very, very warm. Thank you. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Safe and sane and sober, because I have not always been. And it's conceivable, what with the psychology of an alcoholic being what it is, it's conceivable I may not be safe and sane and sober again someday in the future. It sounds like kind of a defeatist attitude going in to say that next year I might be the drunkest guy going. But it's something I want to remember, because my experience leads me to believe that people who get drunk are people who forget that it can happen to them, who get well. I have yet to see, in my experience, anybody well enough to not be in a nut house who has been too sick to stay sober in AA. Anybody that I've ever seen that's been able to function on the street long enough to get to a meeting is able to stay sober gradually. But I've seen a lot of people who have gotten too well to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and who have, in moments of flush of feeling good, cut themselves off from the source of supply. Say, "Well, yes, it's certainly wonderful. I certainly appreciate my sobriety, and if I ever get in trouble, I'll certainly call you." Sometimes this happens after 20 years of sobriety. It makes you want to cry. It used to scare me. I think, geez, if a guy's 20 years sober, can't stay sober, what am I going to do? But I've come to understand, my sponsor taught me that. My sponsor taught me about that. He taught me a great deal about sobriety, and then he taught me one more lesson by dying drunk after many years of sobriety. He taught me exactly what happens when you cut yourself off long enough. So he served a distinct purpose. I don't think that he died as a lesson to me. That's a little bit egotistical, as that most charming young lady who spoke this afternoon said, "I wouldn't want to think that God was destroying other lives to teach me a lesson." That's a little reminiscent of the English whipping boy, where since we can't strike the son of the Lord, we have to hire a little boy to sit next to him, and when the Lord's boy is bad, we'll whip him and hope that he catches on. I don't think that's the way it operates. But I have had a rather checkered career in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always been around. I've been around AA a long time. I very much enjoyed Dave's talk last night. He and I have something in common. We came to AA together in 1949. And when I came to AA, I felt a little bad, because I was growing up in a small northern town, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Norwegian Lutherans, full of Norwegian Lutherans. If you think Baptists are bad news, baby, you ought to see them Norwegian Lutherans. You're not only going to go to hell, but you're going to go to hell in Norwegian, and that's the worst. But when I was growing up there, I felt very bad, because my dad was a very religious man, was a teacher in the community, still is. And I come from a very religious family. It's a small town. It's the kind of town where anytime you do anything, everybody knows, you know. And I'd been in jail a few times, and I'd been kind of a rogue around town, and I was kind of a bad news when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was afraid by that time that I'd already gone too far, that I hadn't done... I didn't have enough left to come back. Now, most people, when they go to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's quite an inspiring story. Bad things happen. Tigers lurk in the emotions when they come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it gets better. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and things went to hell. I went to jail 32 times after I came to AA. After 7 years around AA, do you know where I was? I was secretary of an AA group. And do you know where that group was? I was the secretary of all the patients at Big Spring Nut House in Big Spring, Texas. Gave me a lot of juice around the campus there to walk around reciting the steps. I knew them very well. After 9 years around in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been in a lot of states and a lot of cities. I was in a situation that is not pleasant. It's standing in a cold rain on East 4th Street in Los Angeles waiting for the blood bank to open to get in there and sell that pint of blood for $4. That's kind of a drag. But as I stood there, if I had two consecutive thoughts in looking back, one thought would have been, based on all my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous and all of my lifetime experience, the major thought, if I had two thoughts going, the first one would have been, I am not truly an alcoholic. Not really. I have many symptoms of being an alcoholic, but not really an alcoholic. I wish I were an alcoholic, because then I wouldn't be standing in the cold rain after coming out of the all-night theater to stick out my arm and get $4 for a pint of blood. I knew I wasn't an alcoholic because of one excellent reason. Because in all my exposures around Alcoholics Anonymous, one thing became more and more and more apparent, whether it was in Minneapolis or Beloit or Rockford or San Francisco or Milwaukee or Janesville or Dallas or El Paso, wherever I lived, that the problem of alcoholics is alcohol. And the way to get over the problems of alcoholism is to stop drinking alcohol. And it's a deadly and frightening shock when one day you realize that stopping drinking alcohol doesn't make things get better for you. In fact, things get a little worse after a while when you stop drinking alcohol. And that's why I truly knew that there was something wrong with me, but it wasn't alcohol. Because I'd heard many, many people say it. I'm sure I'd heard it. Maybe I didn't, but I'm sure I did say it. My problem is alcohol. And alcohol was not really my problem. Sometimes it was. Many times it was. But not really. My answer was alcohol. That was the only answer I had. And it got to be a problem. But when I took away the problem, it was just like a guy with an ulcerated tooth taking away Novocaine and saying, I'm swearing off Novocaine. I'm off it. And then one day, about 3 days, it looks as though Novocaine wasn't my problem after all. And it's funny in retrospect, but it isn't funny when you're the one in the catbird seat. When you're the one lying in bed at 4 o'clock in the morning, as I'm sure most of us here have been at one time or another, gazing off into the darkness and wondering why you're different, why you're inadequate, why you're rotten, why you're sick inside, and knowing that you wish it were alcoholism, because you'd be glad to stop if that's what it'd help. But these things, emotions come strong, more strongly when you're sober. So I knew that I wasn't truly an alcoholic. If I had a second consecutive thought, I knew one other thing. I am sick. Evidently, I'm emotionally sick. There's something wrong with me sometime. Not all the time. Even all the time, it wouldn't be so bad. But it comes and goes. It comes and goes. And there's, I've always thought of myself, I am a premier 50-yard dash man. If the world was made up of a 50-yard dash, I'd be president of the world. If the world was asked to every city I ever went into for 50 yards, I was great. 50 yards emotionally, not 50 yards measured off, but for a few days, weeks, months, I'm great. And then you do your 50 yards and you fall panting by the side of the track and there's no tape there and there's no awards, there's no nothing. Just all the rest of them come slogging by. No, it's a marathon today, baby. 26 more miles. And when you discover that you're a dash man in a world that's a marathon race, you're pretty well screwed. You're pretty well wiped out. I know there's something wrong with me. I can't sustain. I can't do anything. I don't know what it is. And I don't know what other people do, but I kept moving from town to town, to city, looking for that city where they were running, or where they were paying off anyway, on the 50-yard dash, where my burst of energy and speed would be rewarded, where I would fit in. I think the most significant line I've ever heard in all of literature is in A Streetcar Named Desire. There's a woman there named Blanche Dubois, and she's a poor, lost soul. She's an alcoholic without being a drinker, just a poor, lost soul, just going downhill on all sides and trying to keep the front up. And in the third act, finally, her sister and brother-in-law commit her to an asylum. And the man comes to take her, and she says, are you going to be kind to me, sir? Yes, we will. We will, Miss Blanche. She said, I'm so glad. She said, I've always depended so much on the kindness of strangers. And that's the story of my life. Depending on the kindness of strangers and unable to find the strangers that would sustain kindness toward me. And so you run. And so you're afraid. And I knew I wasn't, that stopping drinking didn't change it. And I knew that putting the plug in the jug didn't change it. And I knew that going to meetings was fine for 50 yards, but eventually the meetings got to be a drag, and the people got to be a drag, and their own little in-groups became obvious. And so you run again, or else you, like I did in El Paso, I kill myself. That's one way out. I was mentioning this in Amarillo. I was over there, some of you know, last year. It just struck me as kind of funny. Everybody there talking about how they enjoy living in Texas. I was pleased to say I was the only one there who ever died in Texas. You know, I died in a little garage in El Paso, and unfortunately the neighbor pulled me out of there and got my heart started in time so they could get me in the psych ward in El Paso so they could examine me through the slit in the door and finally put me in the Big Spring State Hospital, where I was spent some time. They were going to keep me there till I got well, but thank God they didn't. As a matter of fact, that I shouldn't pass this around, but I am still a patient, an outpatient of the Texas State Hospital at Big Spring. I will never be fully discharged until I get a certificate. All I have to do is go to a psychiatrist and have an examination and have them attest me fit emotionally and send it to them, and I get a discharge. And I just haven't felt quite ready. Just when I think I'm ready, something happens. Somebody bugs me, and away I go. I have a solution, though. I am seeing a psychiatrist three nights a week, Jack F., internationally known conference speaker at Kansas next fall. Went to a meeting with him the other night in Los Angeles. I'm seeing the psychiatrist three nights a week now, and I'm happy to say that he's been sober 7 months, and he's doing a good job. And I can't wait for him to get well so he can straighten me up. I'm really pulling him along slowly. When he gets a year of sobriety and he comes to me and says, Sponsor, I just want to express my appreciation. I'm saying, quick, sign this paper. So I can send it to Texas, you know. But until then, I just have to watch my step in Texas. I spoke in that hospital a few months ago, but I was on my best behavior. You can bet on that. Certainly wonderful to be here. I could just see him coming from the shock ward again. There's the little Yankee son of a bitch now. But that's how I felt sincerely and truly in 1958. And that's why it's kind of strange to find myself standing at this podium or any podium or standing erect anywhere tonight and saying that my name is Clancy Immersland and I'm an alcoholic. Just that is the miraculous thing. I believe tonight, and I have for some years, that I am an alcoholic. And that somehow or other, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has turned out to be not only sufficient for me, but more than enough. More than enough. I've got so far to go in this program that it just makes me aghast sometimes. It would depress me if I didn't have other times when I think I'd already come so far I didn't need it anymore. It just... We kind of alternate in my head. One of my babies accuses me of being a schizophrenic, one of my A babies. He says, I'm the only guy he knows that can go into a closet for every time he wants group therapy. But that's what it said on my commitment papers in Texas. It didn't say this man is an alcoholic or had a drinking problem. It says here is a suicidal schizophrenic depressive. And that's the closest I came to being identified, I suppose. And here I am an alcoholic. It's a funny thing. In the 9 years that I wasn't an alcoholic around AA, as I say, I went to jail, nut houses, lost my four little girls. In fact, I lost my family in Dallas. After I got out of that nut house, I went to Dallas and started over again. And one Monday, I was coming home after a very bad weekend where I'd been spending one of my severance checks. And I just wanted to get in that house and lay down and throw up a while I got my strength back. I'm sure everybody's had that feeling. And I'd think of a new job or a new place to run my 50 yards. And my whole family had moved out. Never knew where they went. Never heard what happened to them. Just bang. Four little girls, youngest one, 5 months old. Just bang, gone. Not only my family's gone, but the furniture was gone. Everything was gone. Everything. Last year I visited that house and I walked in and introduced myself to the tenants. I used to live there. I looked around and just made my heart go, you know. That's something. I didn't see him again for a long time. I see him every day now, because when I was sober about 5 years, they moved to California and we all live together. But I tell you, it was a surprise when they came out, because my four daughters, who'd turned into rather four larger girls now, or then, I remember they got off the train, one said, "Hi, Daddy." And one said, "Hi, Daddy." And one said, "Hi, Daddy." And that little one that comes in, "Hiya, Daddy." Now, I happen to remember I had spawned a Texan. But we got some sharp sticks. But it's, every city I've lived in is replete with failure. I would like to tell you, I wish it were possible for me to tell you, that one morning in California, or one evening, I walked into a meeting, and the scales dropped from my eyes, and I realized what I was and where I was, and it all became different. But that is not correct. What happened was that one morning, I again came out of an all-night theater, and it was raining again, and I couldn't give any more blood for another 3 weeks. So I walked out 60 blocks to the 6300 Club at Wilshire and Fairfax, and I went to sleep in the back seat of an abandoned car, and I waited for the club to open, and I went in. I'd been thrown out of the club previously for hustling, sober, but I prevailed upon the guy. I told him I was sincere this time. I figured I got to stay around here long enough to get a score to get out of this town. If I get to Seattle, if I get a job starting out as a reporter on the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, I'll make a new life. And I went to the club and I stayed around and I haven't had a drink since. Gentlemen here tonight, they didn't know what sobriety day. I remember mine, Halloween. Halloween, 1958. I sometimes kid and say the reason I knew I was in trouble because I'd won a costume prize and I was dressed in my best clothes. But that's not true. I didn't know it was Halloween. All I knew was I had to get out of that cold rain, and there was an abandoned car, and I crawled into it and lay there and cowered. And I went into the club and hustled. And I didn't drink again till now. And I haven't taken a pill other than an aspirin. I have had no therapy. I have had no medications. I've studied no philosophy. I've joined no new religions. It's just incredible. I'm not much, but I'm a long way from that. And everything I am or feel or have is due of all things simply and purely to something called Alcoholics Anonymous that wasn't enough for me 18 years ago, or 17 years ago, or 14 years ago, or 12 years ago, and now is more than enough. I wish there were a magic sentence by which I could explain what happened. But I'll say this. I discovered some things that killed me that I knew, that I thought everybody in AA knew, turned out to be not true little by little, and it saved my life. There are certain facts that everybody knows about AA. Even if you're not an alcoholic, you know, you certainly know it after you come to meetings. AA is a place where you go to learn to stop drinking. And then after stopping drinking, you return to God. And then out of gratitude, you help others to find the same path. And if I continued to believe that much longer, I would have been dead. Because this is not accurate, as far as I can tell. Come to Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking. Is that correct? Everybody knows what real alcoholics are like. They're people who don't draw a sober breath for 20 years. They drink around the clock, night and day. They stay drunk. It wasn't until I was sober almost 2 years that I was able to remove the last reservation here. I was working in a medical corporation, and I was, because I'd had some experience in writing, I was director of publications. And I got in contact with some people at the AMA, not because of this, for some other work I was doing in cancer, writing about. I wasn't doing it. And I stumbled on some interesting facts. Do you want to know something funny? Maybe you feel inadequate, like I used to feel, because you didn't really stay drunk around the clock 20 years. Maybe this will cheer you up. Nobody ever stayed drunk around the clock 20 years. Or 10 years, or 5 years, or 1 year, or 6 months, or 3 months. Under laboratory conditions, it would be just about impossible to keep a human body intoxicated alcoholically for as long as 3 months. Do you know why? Because the body won't let you. The body fights for survival despite how the rest of you are, is, or feeling. The body won't let you stay drunk. The body keeps getting you sober. That's one of the things that makes drinking such a drag. You gotta keep getting sober. You gotta keep getting sober. Come back to the reminders from your loved ones. Well, you've done it this time. You know. The body has all sorts of techniques by which it will not allow you to kill yourself drinking. No matter how badly you want to drink yourself to death, you can't. It takes a long, long time. Usually. Because the body fights back. Part of the body, oddly enough, sets up a desire for more alcohol, and the rest of the body fights it off. So when you get sick enough, your body says, enough, and makes you so sick you cannot stay drunk. It not only won't take any more alcohol in, it starts removing it. I don't think there's anybody here who is unfamiliar with watching their body in action. I doubt if there's anybody here who hasn't kneeled at Vespers at 6 o'clock in the morning. I doubt if there's very few people here who haven't had the exquisite sensation of watching your body in undue stress use every exit at once. Boom. Which I suppose is the background of that old phrase,
I just didn't know which way to turn this morning. If that isn't enough, your body has another technique. The alcohol in the blood. You know, the physiology of alcoholism, I can't imagine why it's always treated so mysteriously by some members or by other people, because there's nothing mysterious about it. It can be charted. As the alcohol level in the blood rises, it affects motor areas of the brain in turn, just like that. Just like that. Speech, equilibrium, balance, which is the same as equilibrium, of course. All the motor areas are affected. By the time it gets to sight, you've got a pretty high level of alcohol. There isn't, you know, a lot of jokes about drunks seeing five people come at them. It's all dressed the same. Which one is the real one, you know? You never see five. You see two when you get to this point. And the reason you see two is for the same reason you speak a little more slurred. And the reason your equilibrium's off, because your area that affects the motor pattern of that part of the body is affected by alcohol in the blood. And eventually your eyes do not focus quite exactly at a triangle. They're just off a hair. And so your body, your eyes feed two different images into your brain. And that's why you see double. Nothing mysterious, nothing magic. But when the alcohol level gets this much and it keeps rising in your blood, your body has to fight to save itself. And it does it whether you like it or not. And I bet most people here have been to a point where their body has saved their life. It drops an iron curtain because the next area to be affected is breathing. And if it gets there, you're going to die. Just that simple. And so it drops an iron curtain. But whoever thinks of it, looks like my body is saving my life. Look, old Joe is passed out. Passed out. It's a physical thing. Passing out keeps your body from taking any more alcohol, so the level won't rise high enough to get into your breathing. Nothing to it. Alcohol is chartable. It's a functional disorder. There's no question about that. And yet, we will always, many of us, go to our death wondering why, when we stop drinking in AA, it doesn't work for us. Without thinking that there isn't anyone in AA who hasn't stopped drinking time after time after time before they ever got here. And if we all go out and drink tonight after this meeting, which is 50-50 that right now, but if we all go out and drink tonight, those of us that survive will get sober again and again and again and again. You get sober again and again. And yet, some jerks like me go to their death wondering why getting sober, which they ask you to do, why doesn't that do it for me? Because getting sober is not such a tough problem. There has never been an alcoholic who didn't get sober. In fact, the medical answer to the functional disease or disorder called alcoholism, the allergy, the sensitivity, is quite simple. If your body takes a substance and over a period of a time it becomes sensitive to it or the substance becomes toxic, there is an answer. Do not ingest the toxic substance into your body. Or, as my loved ones have always told me, don't drink. Now, there isn't anybody here who hasn't heard that mentioned somewhere before they got to AA. Don't drink, and I guarantee you that your body will respond beautifully and you'll feel well. The deadly, unusual, frightening, subliminal curse of alcoholism is not that you don't get sober. Because getting sober, going to do it, and eventually you're going to hurt bad enough to remember what's happening to you. There's nothing deadly here. Alcohol is the safest of all the going-away drugs. It's much safer than Librium. It's much safer than any Milltown. It's much safer than any tranquilizer. It's considerably safer than any of the barbiturates. And it's much more slower working, as a rule. There should be no reason why people die of alcoholism. Because by the time you get sick enough to, you know, to realize what you're doing, you still got time to do something about it. And yet, alcoholism has traditionally been the number three killer in the United States. And according to figures released last year by the American Medical Association, when now combined with tranquilizers and commercial depressants, it has become the number one killer in the United States. It passed ahead of cancer and heart disease. At last, we're number one, friends. Which is a minor consolation if you're the one proving it. Yeah. All right. What makes alcoholism deadly? Something I never learned in 9 years around AA. I'm sure I heard it, but I'm sure I never... It got through to me. In fact, if someone would have said to me in 1958, what do they do at those AA meetings? What do they talk about? What do they run like? Out of my mental picture of AA, even though it was incorrect after hundreds and hundreds of meetings, if they could all be synthesized into one meeting, it would always be a jolly old apple-cheeked, silver-haired, wonderful old fool at the podium thing. Friends, I drank around the clock for 49 years, day and night. And then one day I walked through that door, and the desire to drink left me instantly. I now have $5 million right there, baby, right there. And three different families have come back to me. And I owe it all to one thing. I don't drink. I don't know if I ever heard anybody say that or not, but that's the way my defenses interpreted it. And I died once in El Paso and very nearly died again in Los Angeles before I survived long enough to understand that the curse of alcoholism, the thing that differentiates it from all the other functional disorders, is that the patient finds withdrawal from the toxic substance as eventually as intolerable as the toxic substance. The curse that makes alcoholism deadly is sobriety. Sobriety. Just when you think you're well, you're getting sicker. And that's kind of a drag. And that seems kind of hard to substantiate, doesn't it? Because you all know, and I know, that you come here to stop drinking. Don't give me this talk about sobriety. Just get sober anyway you get it and enjoy it. Sometimes when people are telling you about sobriety, they'll even tell you that they found love. Good. Good. I'm not man enough to take it. It took me my life and some to discover that the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous evidently is what it says it is, time and time and time again. How to learn to live in the world. It's a funny thing about those steps, for instance. People talk about the steps and discuss them and quote them and have step meetings. And it's a funny thing. Don't ever seem to, I never realized that alcohol is only mentioned once in all of the 12 steps, and that's only in the seventh word, and it's never mentioned again. Alcohol is never mentioned again. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous evidently have nothing to do with alcohol, or how to stop drinking, or how to get off it. Every once in a while, somebody comes up to me and say, I just can't seem to get off this drunk. I'll do anything. I'm sure everybody has that experience sometime at a meeting. I just got a drunk and I can't get off it. I can't get off it. I found a way to get off it, if you want to get off it quick. Found it in 1951 in Minneapolis. Found it by accident, like many great inventions or discoveries are made. But if you find someone who's willing to go any length and want to get off a drunk, have them do what I did. Slap a cop. You have just stopped drinking, right there. You have just been medically withdrawn. But it's kind of a hard twist for me to come to think. It took a long time, all my life, to realize that the reason I come to Alcoholics Anonymous is not basically, although it is partially, but not basically, to clench my fists and fight booze day after day after day. So at one time I can say, well, it's been 10 wonderful years of this. Jesus! Ah! You know, I'm not man enough to take that. somehow or other, I have to find a way to live in the world. There's only two ways to get out of the pattern of alcoholism. And the pattern of alcoholism is not a guy in a black coat being born in a black coat on Skid Row and drinking there till he dies, obviously. It's a guy who drinks until his body thrusts him sometimes into sobriety. And in sobriety, he stays until the conflicts of reality get so long and so great that eventually, for emotional self-preservation, he must sedate the reality center. And then he will drink. And he will eventually drink, maybe not get drunk the first day. Sometimes it goes 4 months before you really get drunk. But you'll go till you do. You'll go till you drink to excess. And then back and forth and back and forth. Dr. Block, who's head of this AMA Council on Alcoholism, the investigation board, said he firmly believes that maybe 98% of people who die from alcoholism die secure in the knowledge that what they have is not alcoholism, because it doesn't match their preconception of alcoholism. And he says, way over 50%, he believes, of people who die from alcoholism have never been in jail, never been in a hospital. And that's why you can't really worry too much about who in your group says, you've never been in jail, you're not an alcoholic. Have you ever been in a nut house? In the old days, we were sincere. Yeah. I used to think a lot about the old days when people were sincere. I know when people say, gee, they must have really been something back in the 50s when people were really working at the program. I don't know. When I came to AA in 1949, I got the impression distinctly that the last sincere year was 1942. And after that, it started going downhill. Now it's up to 1959 about was the last sincere year. It's always about 7 or 8 years ago was when they were really sincere. But usually people come here for one reason. The reason is the pattern has driven them to have to try something. Sometimes in retrospect, I think I came to AA because I wanted all-time sobriety. But very few people do, I would think. Because why would you want sobriety? You've had it time after time after time. What's so good about sobriety? It's like having a terrible sickness and you got one medicine. And somebody says, why don't you join our club? We're going to take away your medicine. Hi! You know. People usually, I don't think, come to Alcoholics Anonymous because they want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They come here because they're trying to get away from out there temporarily. I have seen people. In fact, I gave a birthday cake about a year ago to a guy who said that he... His sixth birthday cake, and he and his birthday talk thanked the group, but he said, some 6 years before that, he remembered how bad it was and how he wanted to come to AA and find a new way of life, and it worked for him. And I almost laughed, because when I took him to that first meeting, the only reason he went is because his wife threatened to support him if he didn't. To stop supporting him, I mean. He hadn't worked for some time. She said, if you don't go to that meeting, I'm not going to give you another dime. So he went to an AA meeting. But 6 years later, and looking back, it kind of looks as though he wanted to go. He didn't want to go. In fact, she had to threaten him 7 more times to get him to 7 more meetings before anybody could talk to him. People usually, I don't think, want to go to AA. If you're new or feeling a little cynical, don't feel bad that you're not obsessed with desire for all-time sobriety. Few people are. That's what we're here to find. That's why we work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why we have the therapies within this organization we have. Sometimes it just makes me sick when I see people talk to newcomers and say, all we ask of you is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. God, if they had that, they wouldn't be coming here. If they're lucky, they may find it here after a while. I think it comes right after the 9th birthday. I know it didn't come after the 8th, I'll tell you that. But you work in that direction. We are here because we're caught in a pattern. Now, there's only two ways to get out of this pattern. Either some of us are going to be fortunate enough to become recovered alcoholics and go back to social drinking, and there are sources who say this is possible. One wrote a book on it. The recovered alcoholic, he wrote an article in Harper's called AA Culture Cure, talking about the
excesses of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was on our television station that I worked at in Los Angeles a couple years ago, a year and a half ago. He was smashed out of his mind. He's a 10-year slipper, which is none of my business, but he's got to find a way to recover from alcoholism, because otherwise he's going to have to work them steps or something. He's in trouble. But he isn't doing much lecturing for the last year. Do you know why he's not doing much lecturing? Because one of his recoveries, who has returned to social drinking, eventually, as must always happen, drank finally to excess and was so upset that he went over to the good doctor and knocked his teeth out. When his prosthesis is completed, he'll be back to cure you next year. But he ain't going to cure me next year. There doesn't seem to be any way up till now of stopping drinking. There's a new research going on. I read about it in the paper 2 weeks ago. Maybe you did too. The enzyme therapy, whereby replacing or adding enzymes to the body, it might be brought about. This may be the answer, but I'll guarantee you somebody else is going to try it for a long time before I try it. I think the theories of alcoholic physiological alcoholism always amused me, not amused me, they've enchanted me. The major theory today, and I believe it's probably as close to being correct as anything, is that alcoholism physically is caused by a malfunctioning of the endocrine or ductless glands. Nobody knows why or how, but that's what the theory they're going on. But I wish I'd known that 15 years ago. So when my wife came out to the porch in Chicago where I was laying in the snow, getting my strength up to go inside and change for work, and she would discuss this with me.
Little babies in the house and neighbors looking, and here you are throwing up in the snow on our front porch, you know.
I could say, please, I have a malfunctioning of my endocrine or ductless gland. I would not try to push this for you. I am asked here to talk about how I feel. I have come to believe with every fiber of my being that the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to get sober. It is something that has not been done previously with people like us. It is to maintain sobriety, but not only maintain sobriety, but maintain it out in the same environment in which it's scientifically impossible for me to maintain sobriety. And that's charitable, saying that my conflicts will rise to a point where I must sedate. And the fact that anybody is in this room tonight indicates there must be some way, something here, whether you believe it, whether you're getting too well for it, or whether you think you're too sick for it. Something is allowing people like us to go, not only to sit here, but to go out in the world. That brings me to my favorite thing, I think, that I have come to believe. Sometimes we get this meeting or this conference or our home group confused as Alcoholics Anonymous. This meeting tonight is not Alcoholics Anonymous. That book called Alcoholics Anonymous is not Alcoholics Anonymous. The people here are not Alcoholics Anonymous. The meetings and the book and the people are tools toward Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is something that I have to try to find after the meeting out there on the street, in the world, where I have to live where the tigers lurk. I never had any trouble being spiritual between 8:30 and 10. It's that 10:05 when I got to go back out there again and I'm nothing. You know, nobody cares. Best example I ever had in my life of that, when I was 6 months sober. Somebody interceded for me. And I was still sleeping in the backseat of this car, and they got me a job as a dishwasher at the Gaty Delicatessen on Sunset Boulevard. And I went up there and I washed dishes for 4 days. And I used to just stand in the kitchen and just be transfixed by what an effort I was making. Like our other speakers, a university man, not a Republican, however, well-educated, good writer, son of 1,000 Norwegian kings, grittily and bravely washing dishes in a delicatessen to show the spiritual growth he's made. Busboys would come by and say, get them dishes out of here. Shut up. After 4 days, I got fired. And the guy fired me. Can you imagine that? Me fired as a dishwasher? And I said, you can't fire me. I'm going to AA over in Wilshire and Fairfax, and I've gone to a meeting every night for 6 months, and I'm trying to find a new way of living. I
I'm trying to get my family back. I'm trying to live differently. And he says, Jesus, kid, I don't know about that. You just don't wash enough goddamn dishes. That's all.
I don't care.
I don't mind saying that I took it constructively. I went out to kill myself and very nearly did. That day, because of the pain and anxiety, I was forced into doing something that just about destroyed me. But that's what the world is about. AA is to help me go out there and learn to sustain my dash as long as it takes to do the dishes. And I still got those dishes to do. Not the dishes of physical dishes, but I work in an office, and they don't seem to understand I'm a sensitive, spiritual, ethereal being. Get that story written and get it out tonight to the UP. Don't you know I spoke at a conference last Sunday? I don't say it, but I think it at them. You know, they don't care where I spoke last Sunday. They want the story to the UP tonight. That's all they care about. Dreadful people. The last job I really enjoyed that had some outlet on was I was advertising manager for Revell Toy Company. 2.5 years ago I left there. I should never have done it. But I used to be able to have a place for my schizophrenia. I'd walk out through the advertising department and say, I want you people to get this copy done, get these boxes designed, and we got to meet the market in New York in 3 months, and let's get it ready, and we got to have it done. And I could walk in my office and slam the door, take one of our little planes and go... But the trouble is staying sober longer and longer, they want you to keep growing up more and more. It's kind of distressing when I can't tell my boss. He knows I'm bald. He knows I got kids in college. How do I tell him? I want to go out and play this afternoon. I don't ask much. Just let me go out and play for a couple of hours. Throw rocks at birds. All right. I am not an Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. Basically, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous to somehow, through the book and you people in these meetings, and I go to a lot of them, to gradually learn to do those dishes out there in the world. One of the tools by which this is done, and everyone knows this, is that you return to God, which gives you the added edge. If I would have had to do this, I would be dead tonight. I firmly believe. Unlike many people, I knew about God from the moment I was born. I mentioned it earlier. The first things I heard about were God. Very similar to many intense religions. Our religion is rather intense. I always knew where the first knowledge I had of God, I knew where he was. He slowly circled the spire of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gave it to sinners, and he gave it to Catholics. You know. Didn't make a hell of a lot of difference. They all lumped together over there somewhere. I mean, do you want the Pope in your White House? Think of it that way. All right. As I got older, I realized God wasn't floating around there. But I got old enough to realize when I was... They said, if you break any one of these 10 big ones on the wall, son, you're going to go to hell and burn forever. And it's a shock when you're old enough to read them for the first time and discover you've already broken 4. You're wiped out. You're wiped out. By the time I was 12, I was starting my countermeasures because I realized if God was existing truly, I was damned for eternity. Now, as I got older, intellectually, I knew that their arguments were not completely sound, perhaps. But it's like that old thing that Hitler used to say. You give me their minds till they're 12, and they'll be Nazis till they're 96. You just let me educate them, plant those conditioned reflexes down there. And as I grew older, I realized that if God existed, I was doomed. And I became a pseudo-intellectual anti-Godder. You know, if God exists, let him strike me dead. If God exists, why does Lucky Luciano live with $4 million in Italy and the Pope dies in bitter pain? Is this God in action? If God exists, why does a gangster in San Francisco die happily in bed and a train in Los Angeles hit a whole busload of nuns and leave them swept alongside the tracks for half a mile? Is this God in action? If God exists, why do massive forces of humans kill each other, each of them shouting, God is with us! There's no God! You know, there's nothing like the 3 o'clock in the morning intellectual discussion with other idiots like yourself. You just hype each other right up to a fever pitch. And it isn't until you're halfway home that the knowledge kind of zips across your gut. Yeah, but you're going to hell. So when I came to AA, one thing I did not want to hear about was God, because every time God was mentioned, it restated his presence and made my life less tenable. Truly. And one thing I don't ever need, never needed, I didn't think, that I always seemed to get into a group where there was an old lady in white tennis shoes who was the group conscience.
Yeah. If you'd find your personal savior, you'd be sober.
I didn't actually hit her, but I thought of it once or twice. Don't tell me about God. I don't want to hear about God. Leave me alone. And in 1958, when I was so out of it, I gave up on God completely, and I said, I don't care how AA and these God shouters holler, I'm going to go for a guy who, there's one guy in Pacific Palisades named Bob Bailey who seems to understand, because I see him in meetings. And I grabbed onto him, and he helped me survive. And he was the only higher power I found. In fact, the day that I started to commit suicide from losing my job, he was clever enough to take that pain and turn it around and used it to drive me to take my first fourth step in 9.5 years around a first written inventory. Can you imagine calling up your sponsor and saying, I just got fired off my dishwashing job. I haven't seen my kids in years. My father hasn't talked to me for 10 years. I'm broke and I'm living in the backseat of an abandoned car, and this is what I got to show for 6 months of going to meetings every night and doing everything I can and helping people move and hustling for dough and... What do you think I should do, Bob?
Why don't you write your inventory?
And I asked him a question. I said, why don't you... I forget what I asked him, but it would have been fun. I said, Bob, in my judgment, it can't work. He says, in your judgment, why, you punk? And he cursed me and cursed me and cursed me. He had no more knowledge of how to work with a newcomer than nothing. I'd been sober longer, I'd been around AA longer than he had, and he was telling me, you know, I could quote the book better than he could. But he got me so mad that I had a nickel in my pocket and this cockamamie check I got from this delicatessen I couldn't cash, I had no identification. So I went back to the AA club instead of going to the ocean to drown myself, and I wrote my first inventory. Give me some paper, Sullivan, and I write my inventory. When I got done with that inventory, friends, nothing changed. I went to bed that night in the backseat of an abandoned car, just a half a day hungrier than I had been when I wrote it. I had nothing going for me, except I had one kind of good little feeling. I said, well, I certainly proved to that goof writing an inventory doesn't work. And that made me feel so good, I dozed right off. It wasn't until 3 months later that, in looking back, I could see what a difference writing that inventory had begun to make in my life. Because I had begun to sublimate my judgment to the judgment of my higher power named Bob Bailey. As a result of sublimating my judgment to him, gradually I found an expanding higher power. There are 3 or 4 guys I got to trust through my cynicism and doubt. And as a result of them, I found one group, the Beverly Hills Stag, where I went every week and went to meetings every night other places. As a result of them, I gradually came to believe, as I was forced little by little into doing things I didn't choose to do and which my judgment told me were non-applicable, I gradually found a higher power called the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the most beautiful thing that ever came to me, I believe. There are people who say, you shouldn't say that because you'll hurt people's faith. And I say, I don't believe that. I know a guy's been sober 25 years using AA as his higher power. Nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous says otherwise. It says you come to find God as you can understand him. And some people can't understand as well as others. I'll tell you, since finding AA is a higher power, I have come to believe in God. I never would have been able to return to God. I never could, because my concept of God was as sick as my other concepts were. I have come to believe in God. And I guess that's why our steps say you came to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. It doesn't say, despite what anybody says to you, it doesn't say return to this immature concept that you've been unable to live with probably and somehow grasp it and be a hypocrite and pretend to believe it even though it's going to kill you. It says you come to believe a power greater than yourself. And sometimes one of the greatest powers you can ever find is an arm that you can grab and say, I failed again. What in God's name do I do now? Just cry it out if you feel like a kid, and then let's try it again tomorrow. Sounds pretty hokey. Doesn't sound like very manly, but it sure does save a lot of lives. And gradually I've come to believe in God. The temptation is very great for me now and any time that I'm speaking about this subject to talk to everybody and say, why don't you come to believe in God, newcomers? And you'll feel solid the way I feel. That's the temptation. But I know if someone would have said that to me, I'd have died if that's what I'd had to find. Because the bridge is too wide and the bridge is out. You take what you can find next and grab onto it. And let it come along day by day and gradually learn to live with whatever power you can conceive. You can pray to power without even believing in it. I am glad that I discovered I did not have to return to God like it seemed to me generations of old ladies in white tennis shoes had told me and spiritual folk had told me. I told you to find God. Now get out of the way. I'm on my way home. We care. Now flake off. I can't conceive of that as the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. Seems to me that we have to not only tell one another, but we have to somehow come to show one another what we're talking about. Can't do it very well. I guess I must be the weakest vessel that I know, but of course I'm the only one I know from the inside, so then it's understandable. Because like most people, I have a tendency when I'm not thinking to compare my inside against your outside, and I always come out second. Look at those serene jerks. How dare they be so calm when I've got problems? And I forget that they're looking from their inside at me and saying, it would be easy if I lived in California. Yeah. And we're all in here for one reason. Whether I like it or not, our book seems to indicate and our experience seems to indicate that sooner or later the conflicts of sobriety will force us to drink. And this is why we are here. And we are given steps. And those steps at first are spooky. It's surprising anybody stays around long enough to work them, really. I can imagine. You're sick, distraught, inadequate, afraid, and most of all, cynical. And what do they tell you to do? First of all, you say you're the world's worst drunk and that you're all screwed up. Then God is going to make you all sane again. Then you're going to turn your problems all over to God and he's going to solve them. Try that next rent day when you haven't got the check. Well, like a guy said to me one time, when I came to AA, he gave me, I had $105 in checks out. And the manager of the club said, turn it over to your higher power. And I did. And the higher power turned it over to Sheriff Peter Pitches. And these steps get worse. What are you going to do? What are you going to do when you're sick and upset and would give anything to rid yourself of the memories of how rotten you are? Going to write them all down on paper to make sure you don't miss any in case you forgot any. Oh, that's right. I almost forgot that one. This isn't bad enough. I'll tell you this. It just seems incredible to me. I've been in jail enough times to know that I'm not a fink. I don't tell. I wouldn't tell on you if we were in jail together. But if it got down to telling on you or telling on me, baby, I tell on you first. I go last. I don't know if I approve of a therapy where I go first. Well, look what I've written. Hooray! 1,000 pages of wonderful things. If that isn't bad enough, you're going to go around and announce them. Hey, I've got eyes for my aunt in Seattle. I'm wanted for mopery in Des Moines, Iowa. Yeah. That may be good therapy, but not for sensitive, frightened people like you and me.
Going to ask God to make me perfect, evidently, so that I can maybe get blue lips like all the people I've always hated all my life, and little blue nostrils and blue lips, and go up to sinners and go, Sam Tusenberg, if fooled up's name, it's Govum Kring. I could go back to the church, and I don't remember Norwegian, I'm in business. Then I'm going to start making amends to people who've been throwing it into me for 20 years? What kind of therapy is this? Here's $10 for calling the cops on me that time. I certainly hope it didn't bother you any. You know. More inventory? Some meditation? Try that some night when you're out of your skull. Go in the closet and meditate. And take some rat poison in case you get hungry. Now, there must be some wonderful... The first time you go through, there must be some wonderful reward waiting at the end, something that'll make it all worthwhile. Must be guarantee of happiness. You are guaranteed that you will be allowed to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and drive across town and let somebody puke on your shoes. Now, how can anybody put down a program like that? And that's why most of us have to be driven by pain to trying these non-applicable things, because you don't discover what they mean till after you've done them. Then they mean something else. Then you can't understand why the guy behind you doesn't see it as clearly as you do. A month after I was going to commit suicide and was driven to take my fourth step, I was sitting in that 6300 club with my glasses off, pontificating, saying, how do you people expect to maintain sobriety unless you're willing to write an inventory the way the rest of us did? You know. I think you could take as a rule of thumb that pain stimulates more action than comfort. I think that most of us, however we look at any given time, have been driven to do the things that got us looking that fair. And I don't know if... I guess there are people who have found all-time serenity. I'm not one of them. I have ups and downs and ins and outs. I could, if I wished to give you this message, I could talk about my rewards tonight. I could tell you that I have my family back. Not only do I have my family back, each of my four daughters represent a reconciliation in a different state. Who is 2 years old. His name is Clancy Imeslin. When I said goodbye to everyone yesterday morning, that little tyke came up, put out his arms, and when I leaned over, kicked me. Glad to see the kid learning what that world is like out there. Kick him first, kid. Kick him first. Not really. I don't sleep in the back seat of an abandoned car anymore. I got my choice of a pretty big house, bedrooms, beds. And I'm not washing dishes, getting down to the person. It's a funny thing. When I was committed in Texas, I was treated as a personality, a grave personality disorder. 10 years before that, I got discharged from the nut house in the Navy for another suicide attempt after the war was over. I didn't want to commit suicide when the war was on. There might be some action. As soon as the war is over, I kill myself. Now, there's a guy that'll do that can't be all bad. They had me listed as a severe personality disorder. Do you know what my job is today? I'm a public relations executive. All I do is go around, get along with people, and write nice things. Have another drink, Clyde. It's on us. Some days I don't feel like it. Some days I just soon punch him right in the mouth. You know, you stupid. But AA allows me to remember that I'm there to wash the dishes, not to describe how they should be washed. Nice to see you, Clyde. How are you? I sometimes go home at night and I think, isn't this ridiculous? My job is to get along with people. If there's one thing I can't do, it's get along with people. I really can't. But it's very nice. I got a family home, got get along well, got some juice going for me around that community in the advertising world and public relations, got some prestige. People respect me pretty much, those who don't know me too well. I don't expect my babies to respect me, for instance. All I ask them to do is obey me. Let them respect me later when they come to realize how much I really have given them. I just want them to fear me for now. And I could say, this is what you get from AA. And once you get this, you're on the road. And that is incorrect, I believe. Do you know why? Some days, my rewards just about suffocate me. Some days when all five kids are going at once, the two cats just had kittens, each of them on the same day, the dog is out and won't come in because she's chasing another cat down the world somewhere, the bills are piling up, my boss wants me to work overtime, I'm supposed to go talk at a meeting in Anaheim, the responsibilities of citizenship are just about killing me, and somebody wants me to mow that rotten lawn today when it's uphill all the way. It's the only lawn in the area. Everything is uphill. You can't even go downhill. It's just uphill. And some days I just find myself saying, I wonder where that abandoned car is, you know. I'd just like to crawl in for about a day and a half and think about it. And then I'll come back. If I get two more rewards this year, I may run away. And I used to find this was rather surprising, but not really. But you know why? Because each reward has made my environment more complex. So it requires more learning to live with it. Rewards have a tendency to say, you're doing so well now, you don't have to try so hard anymore. But to me and the people I know, rewards indicate now you've got to try harder to live with them. Most of us are conditioned to failure. Most of us need a lot of work to condition ourselves to lack of failure, to some success. And especially me. I want to say this most primarily. I don't ever want you to think that I'm being mock humble when I say I'm fallible. I am a fallible human being, and I'm so glad that I survived long enough to realize that that's what AA is for. People like me, as well as the wonderful people. That fallible, emotional people like me can learn to live comfortably in the world when scientifically there's no way this can be done. And what happens? I can stay sober. My mother's Uncle Leo got sober in 1927, 8 years before AA was founded, and has not had a drink since. And when I was growing up, he was always the watchword to our family. Why can't you be like Uncle Leo? He used to drink and carouse, and he'd bust to church every morning. And now he's... And every time I look at Uncle Leo, I swear he hasn't changed his expression since 1927. He has a bad life, I think. And I look at him and I think, that's why I don't stop drinking. Because when I do, I feel like him, and I'm not man enough to take it. I can look like I'm man enough, but sooner or later the 50 yards are up and I say, to hell with it. Or the words that kill people like me, the three words, are not take a drink or I need booze, but the words that come creeping out of your gut when you're lying afraid and inadequate and you got nobody to talk to. And comes those words, what's the use? I've tried. And yet sometimes it takes a lot of work to come to talk to people. It's kind of hard to get used to the idea when somebody says, how are you feeling? It's kind of hard, you know. You say, fine. Because you've been conditioned not to say, I feel inadequate. You know. Because most of the people that ask you how you feel, and you say, you feel inadequate, they give you funny looks, you know. Who do you go talk to? Can you go talk to your wife and say, Marge, I have a sense of impending doom. Oh, you do you? Well, now you've got some post-toasties in your head, too. Think about that, you know. That's why I like to come to AA and talk about how I feel, not how I should feel or how I feel just the times I'm good. This is the only place I got in the world to go and talk about being sick. I can't afford to impress you people with how well I am. I might die as a result of that. I can't go to my office and tell them I feel inadequate some days. I can't go to my home and say I got a sense of impending doom. I can't stop people on the street and say, you know something, they're all against me today. What do you think of that? I can go to my group and say, it's been another one of those days and I'll tell you why. They say, yeah, I know just what you mean. They were that way to me too. Yeah. I am here not because I'm a well, good man who temporarily drank a while. I'm a fallible human being who varies sometimes between feeling superior and inferior, who sometimes can destroy the world with love and sometimes can destroy it with hatred, who varies, but little by little as the years go by, I am learning one thing. I am learning to live in that world. And it sounds like not much to many people, but it sounds like something to me.
I love my children. I would give my life for my children tonight if I were asked to do that. But I would not give up AA for my children. Doesn't that sound strange? Sounds pretty fanatic. But I'll tell you why. In El Paso, I had my children, and they all loved me. And the only thing I didn't have was a way to go in the world. And as a result, I took my children and dropped them off at church and came home and killed myself. And their love didn't change a single thing. My father and mother and I are very close. I'm their only child. My father didn't talk to me for 10 years. I go to Wisconsin, and they cry when I come in. I assume it's gladness. It's nip and tuck, but usually it's gladness. I am very happy that I'm able to help make their declining years something better than the other years were. But if I had to choose between AA and my family, I would have to give up. I'd have to give up my family. It'd be a terrible wrench, but I'd do it, I guess. Not because I'm a good man or a good AA, but when I had my family and had kids and had my wife and had everything going for me, you know what the last words my father said to me for 10 years was? He came to my jail cell in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He says, "Well, you were out drunk last night. You let your little boy die in his crib. I don't ever want to talk to you again." With all the love, with all the kindness, with everything, the only thing I didn't have was a way to go. I would have cut off my head rather than let that little boy die. That's why this little boy is so important to us, because he was born 14 years to the day from the day that baby died. And he said, just a new start. And it's very nice. I can't think of anything I would not give up to maintain Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is not because I'm a good AA. And it's not because I'm a good man, basically. It's because I'm a fallible man who, without a way to go, must eventually be destroyed. Not that it hurts to get drunk, but you have to go back to being a frightened animal living in the world. A harassed animal. No matter how good your front is, or whether you're living in the Bel Air Hotel or outside of the Skid Row, when you haven't got a way to go, you're going to go crazy. Or you wish you would. And you're going to maybe go to jail, but doesn't make... Going to jail isn't all that bad compared to just being out in the street without a way to go. That's the worst punishment of all. I am glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. I am glad that I don't have to count on my gratitude to keep me in action in AA. The times I got gratitude is the times I need action least. It's the times I don't have gratitude that I have to keep doing the jobs that keep me in here. I go to a lot of meetings. I have... to the best of my knowledge, never said no to an AA request in the last 8.5 years. It's nice when it comes to speaking in Oklahoma. It's bad when somebody wants me to wash dishes at a meeting at my length of sobriety and with my wisdom. Would you wash the dishes, Clancy? Internationally known conference speaker. And I feel better after washing the dishes than after I do speaking at a conference. It's the damnedest thing you ever saw. But I try to hide it. I don't want to get a reputation for that. I'm glad to be here. If I ever see you again or not is extraneous, because the jury that will determine whether or not I shall survive lives inside here. I can be the hottest little thing in the world to you people, and if I can't convince me, I'm dead. And it doesn't make any difference what else happens. So I must work on convincing. And I can't convince myself with words. I can only convince myself with actions. The actions I have come to learn will enable me to live more comfortably in the world. That is the secret word of Alcoholics Anonymous. Comfort. Growing comfort. More often and longer. Not always, but little by little. I even found an answer after doing enough things to that phrase that comes to all of us sometimes, I guess, when you're feeling bad or down. And the phrase comes, as I mentioned, what's the use? The nicest thing I think I ever found in my life is when I got thinking one day, what's the use? And there's almost another little voice, maybe the schizophrenic personality kicking in, but saying, for the first time in my conscious life, I had a reason. The reason was that even I was worth saving. And I was able to walk like a man and put my shoulders back and look people in the eye, because I was the most fortunate of men. I was able to identify my disease. My name is Clancy Immersland. I am an alcoholic. Thank God. Thank you.
Clancy, thank you.